Charlotte Talks just marked its 22nd year on the air on WFAE. When the show launched, Charlotte was wrestling with growth, the role of race in public schools, transportation. There were big bank mergers, and the country was headed toward a presidential impeachment. The more things change, huh? What hasn't changed is the importance of listeners' financial support. Click the donate button at WFAE.org or call 704-549-9000. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, North Carolina moves into phase two of its reopening, albeit with modifications in place. COVID cases continue to rise here and mean decisions on the Republican National Convention will be tricky. NCDOT is facing revenue shortages in this pandemic. You'll notice the result of that soon. CMPD names a new chief. The Manor Theater has shown its last reel of film and popped its last kernel of corn. And Charlotte elbows San Francisco out of its place as the 15th most populous city in America. Our roundtable of reporters is ready to flesh out those stories and more. Steve Harrison is WFAE's political reporter. He joins us this morning. Welcome back.
Thanks, Mike.
You're welcome. Jonathan Lowe is a reporter anchor for Spectrum News. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Mike.
Andy Ma covers education and other things for the Charlotte Observer. Thanks for joining us.
Morning.
And Eric Spanberger is here. He is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Welcome to you.
Greetings, Mike.
Greetings. Okay, today was the day, Friday, if you're listening on Friday morning, today is the day that at 5 o'clock this afternoon we will move into phase two of the reopening, the economic reopening, but it's turned out to be slightly less than what people were hoping, Governor Roy hoping for. Governor Roy Cooper has shifted our stance from stay at home to safer at home.
Phase two is another careful step forward. Since we announced phase one, the state's overall key indicators remain stable. However, the increases in the COVID-19 cases signal a need to take a more modest step forward in phase two than originally envisioned.
So what's going on that they've pulled back on the complete phase two adoption?
Well, the numbers that they're seeing, remember it was what, last Saturday you had the highest case count to date in terms of positive cases in North Carolina. And then just yesterday, I think you had somewhere close to 800, 783. And what you heard from the governor and the head of Health and Human Services is that they expected the numbers to go up with expanded testing, but they didn't expect them to go up this much. And so that's why they're being more conservative with this phase two.
Yeah, and I'll say this just about the expanded testing. I mean, I think, Eric, that's 100% right. That we are testing more and the numbers are going up. But it's important to note that like everyone in the country is testing more. And so it's not just North Carolina. And so, you know, not everyone in the country is seeing cases still go up. So it's not just about testing. And they, I guess yeah. They kind of delaying phase two kind of owned up to that this week.
Go ahead, Mike. Sorry.
I was just going to say that nationally, health experts are now saying that we're likely to see a substantial rise in cases in southern states because we have been more aggressive at reopening our economies quickly and perhaps too soon. So we'll see what happens, I suppose. But what were people hoping would happen in phase two, and what is going to happen at 5 o'clock? Go ahead, Andy.
Well, people were hoping for a fuller reopening than what we're getting. And I think one of the things that stood out is something that we're holding off on is gyms not being able to reopen. And a lot of things are going to come back, but at a pretty limited capacity. And go ahead, John.
So originally gyms, bars, nightclubs, public playgrounds were to open. Now they're not, nor are movie theaters, bowling alleys, or museums. Mass gatherings still limited, right? To what, mm-hmm. 10 people inside, 25 outdoors. But religious services are exempt from crowd limits. That's a result of a lawsuit that was filed, I think, last week and allowed churches to open. Prior to last Sunday's services, that all came down. So how many local churches, synagogues, mosques reopened last weekend to congregants? How was it a problem, or did I know that some churches got together and said we're not going to do this?
Yeah, there were 75, right? 75. There was a letter signed by 75 Charlotte churches saying it's too soon. You know, I think if you go out into the neighboring counties and the more rural areas, that they're going to be much more willing to open. But right, I'm not sure if very many Charlotte places of worship decided to meet inside.
But one of the things, Mike, going on with this, when you're talking about things that reopened and expectations, you're seeing a lot of pushback from the hotel and hospitality industry, and they are frustrated in particular with those limits on mass gatherings, 10 indoors, as you said, and 25 outdoors, which really means you can't even book family reunions and other kinds of events that hotels need to really make that comeback. You're seeing a lot of pushback in Charlotte and across the state with hotel lobbyists and hotel executives saying, hey, wait a minute, we need some help here. This is too slow.
And this is going on. I mean, I think it's now the state can modify this. They can modify phase two at any time, but this order goes through June 26th. This is 5 weeks, which of course that's an eternity in this outbreak. And I think it'll be interesting to see if they come back in 2 weeks and loosen this up. But kind of all around the country, and even here in North Carolina, governors, I think, are seeing it's getting harder to keep control and more, even in blue states, there are local counties that are increasingly going their own way. So
I'll just add in there, though, changes. I'll just add in there, though, that, you know, the specific counties have, the governor said that these specific counties can do really, you know, they can enact their own restrictions, but, you know, they can also go the other way. And I'll just point out in Gaston County, while the folks over the county wanted to loosen things up a couple weeks ago, you had mayors of the smaller communities come out and say, no, we don't want to open up that quickly. So while you do have, you know, folks on the other side trying to reopen things, I do think there's an element in the community of let's not do too much too soon, because of yesterday we just had this, you know, it's the second most, as Eric pointed out, the second highest daily day over today increase. And so I think the folks, there are, like I said, there are people that still want to take things slowly, even though there is this pressure to reopen.
I think what Steve's getting at, though, is this really interesting political tension, particularly at the state level. On one hand, they want to open up and they say they like the trends. But then on the other hand, you have these jumps that far outstrip just the notion of additional testing. And then you have all this pressure from people who feel cooped up, and you have the businesses that are frustrated and want to get back going. And all the while in the background is, how risky is this, as we're seeing these big numbers in North Carolina?
And the onus is really on is on individuals to do the right thing. And it's really easy to, it would seem to me, to fall back into old habits. We all grew up with our particular social distancing individual rules about how close we want to be to other people. And it's easier to fall back into that than it is to maintain 6 feet or even, for some reason, wear a mask. Restaurants, as people have pointed out, hospitality, particularly restaurants, have been among the hardest hurt businesses in the shutdown here and around the country. But even among restaurateurs, there is a difference of opinion on how quickly they should reopen. Anthony Derish, who owns the Picante on Moorhead Street, told WBTV that he was eager to have his customers back inside.
For me, we need the money, and that pays our bills, not only here at the restaurant, but our bills at home.
But Picante's neighbor, Greg Otten, who owns Pinky's West Side Grill, told WFAE that he was taking a more cautious wait-and-see approach.
That first week, you know, everybody's going to be really, really busy. And I would really hate for somebody to make a mistake and, you know, cause some sort of outbreak here. I'd hate to be known as that guy.
So into which camp do you think most restaurateurs fall?
I think it's split. I've talked to a lot of restaurants, Mike, in the last 2-3 weeks. And, you know, you hear basically those two cuts that you played, that really represents, you know, the restaurants that are hurting and are eager to open just for reasons of keeping people employed and keeping their business operating. But on the flip side, you know, you have restaurants and what I think people, what that second cut really speaks to is what businesses across the city are going to have or can afford and have the resources to put certain protocols in place.
I mean,
right. So we've seen a lot of places like gyms and other places that have opened up have started doing temperature checks. as people come in the door, limiting the number of people that come in, already having stuff blocked off that, you know, you have social distancing already in place. So I think a lot of restaurants and businesses in general face that decision. Do we have enough in place? Do we have enough protocols in place to keep people safe?
I think one thing too with restaurants that I don't think a lot of people realize is they operate on razor thin margins. And right now the requirement to only operate at 50% capacity is going to be really tough for them, because even on a full day, even with a full season, like they only have a couple of days of cash in the bank.
Right. And the one thing that we're dealing with right now to that point is the increase in meat prices. You know, a lot of restaurants all restaurants are being hit by increased meat prices on red meat, beef, pork. And so most of them, that's where their money's going right now. Some of them are even having to raise prices.
Well, it's not just the fact that they can't make it probably on 50% capacity. It'd be very difficult for restaurants to do that. But this is going to be the first weekend. Tonight will be the first dinner out that a lot of people can avail themselves of. And it would seem to me that all this pent-up demand is going to cause people to flood to these restaurants that can only operate at 50% capacity. So as you go in and they stop you from coming in, are you willing to wait in a line outside down the block to get in and not social distance? How will restaurants handle this?
Well, we can look to South Carolina as some indication, because they're, what, 2 weeks ahead of us and have been spotlighted nationally for, I guess, leading the way on reopening. Just looking at the case count yesterday, you know, I think they had a number of new cases, but no new deaths. So I just wonder, and I pose that to say, you know, are our state officials here in North Carolina looking at what's happening day to day in South Carolina as an indication of how to do this and what restaurants and barbershops, South Carolina, they're already open. So
yeah. I'll jump in real quick. I've been in South Carolina for a few days, just working remotely, and in the restaurants here, they have really blown out their outdoor space. I mean, they've not only put tables outside, but they've like taken over areas outside that weren't even part of their restaurant in an attempt to expand their space. And I think that's one thing in North Carolina that a lot of Republicans wanted, was to limit capacity inside restaurants to 50%, but let restaurants go essentially as many tables as they could with social distancing outside. Hmm. And, you know, that would give them a chance, like Andy said, to generate more revenue.
Phase two, which begins tonight, 5 o'clock on Friday, also opens hair and nail salons, swimming pools, which kind of disturbs me. But again, the capacity in all those locations will be at 50%. I don't know how you determine the capacity of a swimming pool. They'll be opening day and overnight camps. I don't know what the capacity restrictions on those are. Does anybody? And yesterday, there were reports beginning out of New York that this COVID virus affects children in a very different way than it affects adults. And they're seeing all kinds of cases break out. And they're also going back and looking at medical records of cases that perhaps they had, but they didn't know what it was prior to COVID. And they're finding that this has been going on a while. And they are recommending that day camps and overnight camps not reopen, because kids are in trouble if they get this virus in a different way from adults. And by the way, the chairman of the Gaston County Commission told WSOC yesterday that he was urging businesses to ignore whether the governor is allowing them to reopen and just go ahead and do it. He's been a kind of a maverick on this for quite a while, but law enforcement was quietly urging businesses to ignore the commission chairman and follow the governor's order. This is really getting sticky. We'll talk more about the COVID-19 phase two reopening, prices rising, outbreak of COVID-19 at a Tyson plant, and more when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Jonathan Lowe is here from Spectrum News. Annie Ma from the Charlotte Observer. Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal. And Steve Harrison from WFAE News. Phase 2 begins at 5 o'clock on Friday afternoon. That would be today if you're not listening to us on Saturday morning. Although this is not the case in other parts of the state, Mecklenburg County public health officials stopped short of mandating face masks. They're strongly encouraging people to wear them in public settings, but restaurants open tonight. Does that mean waiters and waitresses don't have to wear face masks? That's what that means.
I believe okay. So. I believe so. I mean, through phase one and the full out stay at home order. I mean, I've been going in takeout places and have seen employees not wearing masks. So,
because the masks are there not to protect the wearer, it's to protect the people they're dealing with, others. Governor Cooper correct. Says a face covering signifies strength and compassion for others. What does it say about us that we are, so many of us are unwilling to take that simple, small step and wear a face mask?
I think the face mask has really become, to a lot of people, this political thing, and it's
yes,
become...
thanks to the president, yes.
Yeah, and you know, you see videos of reporters, not here in Charlotte, but in other markets, like being harassed for wearing a face mask by while covering these reopen protests, and it's kind of taken on a life of its own. So, you know, there's the inconvenience factor, but there's also this like statement that people seem to be making with it.
And you know, not to you, I get looks. You know, and I'm a person of color, and I wear a mask every single solitary day. But you know what? I don't really care because I don't want your germs, and I don't think you want my germs either. That's just being plainly honest. You know, I don't think it to associate protecting me and protecting you is not a political statement. Absolutely. It is simply we are. You know, I think about my mother, my uncle who had you know, heart surgery. That's who I think about when I wear a mask and I go out in public and I see people their age limping around and already look like they're not in great health, not wearing a mask. It just.
Yes. It's why you wash your dishes and your clothes.
Exactly.
It's why you do it.
I think this is interesting, though, from a political standpoint. You see that hesitation when you hear Gibby, or you hear that hesitation when you hear Gibby Harris, the public health director, Dina DiIorio, the county manager, while they are urging people again and again and again to wear their masks. They don't want to mandate it. I suspect some of that is because you would have a difficult time getting all six of the towns to agree to go along, much as we saw with the stay-at-home, switching from the tighter restrictions from a county perspective to the looser state stay-at-home. So I think this is a similar path.
So around the country, critics have been they've been critical of the capricious nature in some cases of these closures. Certain businesses are deemed critical, others are not, and they're very similar in type. Are the rules that we've been under receiving the same criticism?
I mean, I think yes. I think since phase two was announced and it was more restrictive than we thought, I think that there have been a lot of people questioning it. I mean, the big one would be bars. Right? What is a bar? Is a tap room a bar? If you have a kitchen, does that count? I mean, the one that was the head scratcher to me was we talked about earlier that overnight kid camps are allowed, but outdoor playgrounds are still roped off. Mm-hmm. And it's not going to be perfect. There's no perfect order that makes it fair. But yeah, I think a lot of people are starting to say, you know, does some of these make sense?
And Steve, to that point, I think one of the things that's really interesting is, remember, Roy Cooper last week, the Washington Post poll, he had, 75% approval. The Meredith poll, I think he was in the 60s or 70%. This is a really delicate time. Obviously, we have the public health crisis, which is number one. But then number two, watching 2020 elections, this could be a really delicate time for the governor and his administration.
And for those watching this who are frustrated by the pace of the reopening here in Mecklenburg County, they should know that restaurants, salons, and barbershops in Durham will not be reopening today. They will have to wait till June 1st because of a decision by the Durham Board of Commissioners. Durham is the state's sixth most populous county, and they have the third most reported cases of COVID-19. The day after Governor Cooper announced a transitioning to this modified phase two of reopening, the state reported 21,085 COVID-19 cases and 735 deaths. 788 more positive cases of COVID-19 were reported last Saturday. As we've said already, the state recorded its highest one-day total of new cases. Mecklenburg County is reporting 73 deaths as of this morning. So far, the highest number of cases in the state is here, 2,921. Are these cases going up mostly because of an increase in testing? Because I think we've done, 13,000 tests or something like that?
Yeah, so we were at 2,500 to 3,000 tests through much of April. And then you remember the governor said he wanted to be at 5,000 to 7,000. Since May 13th, the state has been 8,000 or above in terms of number of tests. But clearly, going back to Steve's point, while they knew and they said there will be more cases because there's more testing, the fact that they're doing a restrained or modified version of phase two is a clear indication that they don't like what they're seeing. In fact, Mandy Cohen, who's the head of Health and Human Services, said during the press conference Wednesday, she said, I would have liked to have seen this leveling off, and it's not. So there clearly are numbers in there that they're seeing that they are nervous about.
Well, in North Carolina, like I said earlier, North Carolina is testing a lot more. But we're still, if you look at North Carolina's testing compared with the other 50 states, we are still near the bottom. So we are not doing anything out of the ordinary and doing this incredible job of testing that other people aren't.
There's some confusing numbers, and maybe it's just me because I'm not great at math, but listen to these numbers and you tell me if they make any sense to you. According to WFAE's healthcare reporter Claire Donnelly, the number of positive coronavirus tests is declining while the number of people hospitalized with COVID-19 is stable. And then you have State Health and Human Services Secretary Mandy Cohen saying the state's overall number of cases is continuing to increase. Those facts seem to be at odds with each other. Am I missing something here?
I think it might be that Claire's saying the number of cases that you get every day is going down, but that would still mean the total number of cases is going up. Like if you add 50 one day and 40 the next day, you still have 90 more than 2 days ago. But that's just, that's how I interpreted that. Okay.
And I think one thing with the hospitalizations too is more testing is available and more people are diagnosed. You start officially counting people who have it, who feel bad, but not bad enough to go to the hospital. You know, so early on, the people who were counted positive were really sick and they were in bad shape and they ended up in the hospital. So now you're getting more and more people. I mean, a month ago, a lot of people were told, like, assume you have COVID. We don't have a test for you. And they didn't go to the hospital. So I think there's a little bit of that that difference.
So when this all started, CATS reduced their operating hours and reduced the number of buses and trains, but they also, because they wanted to keep the number of people riding down, but they also made the fares free, which is counterintuitive to me at least. Now they are deciding that they're going to change all of that. What are they planning?
Well, so they're doing a gradual ramp up of frequency of service, and it's largely going to be based on demand. In terms of the fares, Mike, the reason that they got rid of the fares is they wanted to minimize interaction between passengers and drivers to limit potential community spread. So that was the thinking behind that. And one of the things that's interesting is CATS recently said that they're expecting ridership for the year that ends June 30th, the fiscal year that ends June 30th, to be off 18%. So, you know, they had most of the year until you get into March. That shows you how dramatic the drop-off has been.
They're going to start going back to fares, and they're going to increase the schedule of buses and trains. When does that begin?
June 8th.
Okay. It's been previously reported, we talked about it, I think, last week, so it's not your imagination, that grocery prices are on the rise, but now restaurant prices will start to go up. Is that simply because they're trying to make up for lost revenue, or is it because the price of meat and other staples is going up?
Yeah. So, Mike, two dozen major meat processing plants across the country that do beef, pork, and other red meat have had to shut down because of COVID-19 outbreaks. You know, meat processing plants, people that work there, they're right, especially on the line, they are very close together. And so that led to a 28% drop in the amount of beef, pork, and other red meat compared to the same time last year. So there's just, it's really hard for, I talked to the owner over at Dilworth Neighborhood Grill earlier this week. He is one that has decided not to raise prices. He's just absorbing the cost. They've done some other things like grocery delivery, trying to fill that gap. But they are paying more for meat. But you look at a place like Brooks Sandwich House or Sandwich Shop, they've already had a really tough 6 months, starting with the murder of Scott Brooks.
Yeah.
They had to post something to social media earlier this week, much like a lot of other restaurants across the area, saying that it's either we close or we raise prices. And you have to think that's a hard decision for an owner who's got people to got employees.
And speaking of that, you put that on top of the fact that they're absorbing all these costs for the enhanced cleaning and sanitation and changes they're having to make to the restaurant at the same time that they're cutting capacity to 50%. There is so much financial pressure on restaurants. It's really a difficult situation.
And I really am concerned. I'll just really small point. It really concerns you on how the ones that will be able to reopen and have the proper protocols in place and the ones that, you know, just won't even be able to get all that together and have to make the decision to close.
And speaking of meat plants that are having a tough time and disrupting the supply chain in the process, last week or this week, Tyson Foods reported 570 cases of COVID-19 at a poultry processing plant in Wilkesboro. They tested over 2,000 employees. So if you test 2,000 and you get over 570 people coming down with it, that means over a quarter of the employees have it. Why are meat processing plants seemingly so susceptible to this?
Well, people like on the processing line, they're packed really close together. It's really hard to social distance. And
can't that be changed? I mean, seriously, can't that be changed? Can't they spread them out?
They're working on that now.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of them are putting in, they've scaled back operations. So that means you have fewer employees there. But also, I think they're, you know, those that work on the assembly line, or not really an assembly line, but the production line.
Disassembly line.
Correct. You said it. Putting partitions so that people are spaced out. But one point about the Tyson Food plant in Wilkesboro, the most of those people were asymptomatic. We're not showing any symptoms. So that there is also another concern, because you have people who just don't, you can spread it, but you don't know you have it. And so even with scaling back operations, there's still a concern. I know that the plant has done some deep cleaning, several rounds of deep cleaning, and also, like I said, scaling back operations. But, you know, that's a lot of people that did not know that they even had it.
Another reason for face masks. You reported this week, Jonathan, that we should start getting used to untidy grass and bumpy roads, because NCDOT is experiencing revenue woes and cutting back as a result. This may seem like a silly question, but considering what COVID-19 is doing to the economy, but exactly how does COVID-19 relate to the revenues brought in by NCDOT?
So basically, NCDOT has been very honest and said that they have depleted their cash reserves, that they have had a serious drop in revenue because people simply aren't driving. They get a lot of their revenue from gas taxes, and gas prices are extremely low right now, and they're not meeting people on the road. I mean, I haven't filled my car up in about a month and a half. And so NCDOT, there is a safety concern, because you think about, take Independence Boulevard, where I was earlier this week. You know, there are a lot of places where you merge onto Independence. People are doing 60 miles an hour. And you can't see over the grass, because the grass has gotten, it was past my waist. Pedestrians walking down Independence having to sometimes, I saw, step out into the road or the curb because the sidewalks are blocked by so much grass. There's a lot of litter. And so NCDOT said that they usually do six-week cycles of grass mowing across the state. They have reduced that to half, so they will only do three cycles starting next month. And then it's also important for people to know that they usually do two litter sweeps statewide. There was one that was supposed to happen in April. That one had to be scrapped. Not sure what's going to happen with one in Fayetteville. In the fall. So people need to know at least things aren't going to be looking great. But you can reach out to NCDOT if there's an area where it's unsafe, you can't see. So I'm sure that NCDOT will start to hear more from the public on that.
They also announced 9,300 employees have been asked to take unpaid time off between now, I think, and the end of June. And they don't just impact the rank-and-file employees. Senior leadership teams and executives are also going to be asked to take this time off. How much money will that save them?
It's supposed to save them about $7 million annually. But, you know, as we know, they're really strapped for cash. And then, as Eric knows, they have some serious money woes and mismanagement.
Yes, let's talk about that for a second, because the auditor, state auditor, did a overview of NCDOT's finances, and hundreds of millions of dollars, evidently, has gone missing. Does that figure into the shortfall of cash?
Well, so they have a lot going on at the Department of Transportation. Let's put it that way. So on top of what Jonathan just explained, and the fact that you have lower tax revenue from car sales and fuel sales, the auditor had found that there was $740 million of overspending in 2019. Now, that's the important part here, Mike, because remember, that's pre-pandemic. So they had all these issues going on. The Secretary of Transportation, Jim Trogdon, retired in February. Before that, the state treasurer had said he should go. So you have a number of issues at play here. And by the way, the state auditor also point blank said poor management, mismanagement were to blame, and that the department needs to turn things around immediately. So they have a lot of work to do. Let's put it that way, euphemistically.
Will we find out the cause for this hundreds of millions of dollars in missing cash? Will we find out the cause at some point?
I'm not so sure it's missing cash. It's overspending from the budget. That's what they're
basically
talking about.
Their balance books are not keeping track of what they're spending.
It's not that they can't find the money. It's that they spent more money than they should have.
Okay, so June 30th marks the end of the fiscal year. That's when they're supposed to take these unpaid vacations or furloughs. Will that continue into the new fiscal year? Does anybody know? I have 5 seconds.
Don't think we have the answer to that yet.
We have to take a break. We're coming back with more in just a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's the Local News Roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Steve Harrison is with us, a reporter for WFAE News, Jonathan Lowe for Spectrum News, Eric Spanberg, Charlotte Business Journal's managing editor, and Annie Ma, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. CMPD Chief Kirk Putney was to have been retired by now. He was planning to retire, come back for the Republican National Convention in August, and then retire again. The state said that wasn't legal, so he stayed on for the convention, which may or may not happen. But this week, the department named his replacement, Deputy Chief Johnny Jennings.
The Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department, in my mind, is one of the finest agencies in the entire country. The city of Charlotte is one of the finest cities in the entire country. And to be able to take on this leadership role with our Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department, it means a great deal to me.
In fact, he said he was humbled to get the job. So, who is Johnny Jennings?
Well, Johnny Jennings has been with CMPD for the same amount of time that Chief Kirk Putney's been there, since 1992. So he's been there quite a long time, was promoted to deputy chief back in 2016, but he's been integral in some of their running some of their major events like DNC, He currently runs their community services bureau, so he's front lines, if you will, with the community.
He also applied for the chief's job when Kerputny got it, and then he was named to be deputy chief. So are we to assume that there's not going to be a lot of policy change once he takes the reins in September?
I think that's a fair statement, and I didn't hear anything in the news conference that suggested a change of direction. I think it's interesting. This was a decision made, in Charlotte's former government, the city manager hires and fires people like the police chief. When Rodney Monroe was hired a while back, there was a group of finalists, and there was kind of public input, and the public were allowed to interview them. This time, this decision was made. City Council found out about the announcement about 45 minutes before they said it. It was a decision that the manager made completely on his own. Wow. And I'll be curious if there is any kind of shift, because of course we're in this huge homicide problem, and whether there's any kind of different approach moving forward.
I talked, Mike, with Robert Dawkins at Safe Coalition NC, and his group has been, when it comes to Steve's point of violent crime, that Deputy Chief Johnny Jennings has been working closely with community groups in isolating. Remember we talked about a month or two ago about CMPD identifying hotspots around the city?
Yes.
Johnny Jennings, according to Robert Dawkins, was integral in that process. He also, which we found out during the news conference, was the person that developed the whole paid college internship program, so helping them to retain and recruit officers. So there were some little, I guess, tea leaves in there of the kind of person that he is. The chief even said that Johnny Jennings is nicer. which what Chief Putney said is a relief. I don't know if that is an indication of the type of chief we'll see, if there will be any, I don't know, policy change. I don't know, but maybe a different type of leader.
If you drive, and not many people have been driving recently because of the COVID-19 outbreak, but if you drive down Providence Road, the marquee outside the Manor Theater has been saying temporarily closed because of this pandemic. But on Wednesday, Regal Theaters announced that Charlotte's oldest movie theater, the Manor, which opened, by the way, in 1947, will not be reopening. This is a Myers Park landmark. Movie theaters all over the city are closed. This is the last quote unquote art house that we have. Put this closure into perspective. Is this just because of streaming services and you can get anything you want on television now, or is this something else happening here?
Well, I mean, I think Manor is a small theater. It only has two screens. It's called the Manor Twin. So it must be really hard to operate that and keep that going when, you know, you can't have people coming in to see movies. And it's been, I know that since I've been here for a year or so, there's always just been rumors of like, is the Manor Twin closed? Is the Manor Twin closed? Like, is this the end? And sadly, now it is the end.
This is not the first time that we've had this conversation about Manor. You know, it's switched hands a couple of times. But I will say its current owner was Regal. And if you remember pre-pandemic, I believe Regal owned the theater over at Park Road Shopping Center.
Yes.
Am I correct?
Yes.
And they let that go. It's now, it closed down and now it's reopened as an AMC theater. Mm-hmm. The movie industry was already hurting. That may be part of it, but it's really sad because the Manor is the place where those independent films that aren't going to make it into the bigger theaters, the Manor Theater would take them. And so that's where these independent filmmakers would get their start.
The landlord of that shopping mall, which is anchored on two sides by Panera Bread and Dijai Restaurant, is planning to turn the part of the shopping center that is now the theater into office space. I'm not sure that's a very smart decision in this world where we're all working from home and may continue to do so when this all comes to an end. Now we must talk about something that's on the calendar but may or may not remain on the calendar, and that is the Republican National Convention. Okay, CNN ran a story yesterday about Charlotte's hosting the Republican National Convention and reported that the state is feeling the pressure from the president on down to reopen faster so that we'll be ready to help the RNC and provide the president with his national showcase. The president has been criticizing states with Democratic governors, including ours, for not opening things up quicker. He says that we have been lagging our neighboring southern states for too long. And on Thursday, in an interview, he said he will have to be careful about holding the RNC in Charlotte because the state has a, quote, Democratic governor. Actually, Democrat governor, because the Republicans don't say Democratic, who is playing politics with the reopening. So is that what Cooper is doing here, playing politics? Or is it the president who is playing politics?
I don't have an answer for you on that, but I just think it's interesting watching everyone dance around this convention. I mean, it's just the New York Times story this week said that the president has broached the idea of maybe just doing it in Florida. Meanwhile, you have Marsha Lee Kelly, who is the head of the RNC convention, saying it's full steam ahead. Ronna McDaniel saying similar things, but also hedging a little bit, and Tom Tillis, I can't remember if we talked about this already, Tom Tillis expressing some doubts as to whether you can have that size of an event when you're just now starting to reopen businesses. And by the way, I don't think that when you have a maximum of 10 people indoors as probably June 26th, how in the world in 2 months are you going to go from 10 people to 19,000?
Well, yeah, you know what?
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jonathan.
I was just going to say, and Steve can attest to this. So, you know, when the news conference about announcing the new CMPD chief, they gave, just like they gave city council 45-minute lead time, they gave the media, and I'm getting to a point here, gave the media 45 minutes. Well, some of us, I know at least me and maybe Steve, thought we were going to get some other questions in there about general topics, maybe that this would be about RNC, since there were so many questions. That news conference went from start to finish and ended without any other questions outside of the CMPD police chief. So, and they knew that Steve wanted to ask a question about RNC, much like all of us, but we didn't get that opportunity. Well,
the mayor has been, this has been controversial since almost the very beginning, and the mayor has been staunch in saying we want to welcome the RNC to town because we are an inclusive city. And then she started saying we have to welcome them to town because we have a contract. And last week on this program, I asked her a couple questions about this. Note how she sidesteps a question I asked about whether we're ready for a gathering of people, 50,000 people, who are proudly snubbing recommendations to wear a mask, including the president himself.
The way that we react and what we do will showcase who we are over the next to the international world. So my goal is for us to do this in a way that maintains our public health awareness and creates an image for our city that works well.
But then, days later, she goes on MSNBC on Sunday singing a very different tune in a different tone of voice.
It has to be about keeping people safe. That means following the science. We've got vulnerable populations in Charlotte. We have people that have chronic diseases. We have our elderly. We need more testing. We need to trace people wherever they are. But we can't go into this with just, well, we agreed to something in 2018 and we're going to continue to do it. That is not the world today.
Steve, what changed?
Well, I mean, I think probably your audience a little bit, being on a national media, but I think it's important to note that even with that stronger tone, the mayor and the city council can pass a resolution that might say we encourage people to wear masks, or they can pass a resolution to say we don't think the event should happen. But this is not something they can control. I mean, the mayor really has nothing to do with this, because this is with Mandy Cohen and Governor Cooper, maybe Gibby Harris, but as we've talked about, the county health department is no longer kind of making its own rules in terms of Mecklenburg County. So I think you're going to see maybe the council give a proclamation or a resolution, but they don't have a lot of control in this. This is moving forward with or without them.
And even Republicans are beginning to change their tune on this, because you spoke, Steve, with Republican National Committee Chairman Ronna McDaniel earlier this week, and I know that she said that by the end of June they would have a better feel for things and that then they might have to make some critical adjustments. But then she alluded to the president having to shift his position, which has been adamant about holding this event.
To be honest, I think he's going to wait until we get a little closer and we can give an evaluation and we get guidance from the governor and the mayor. I mean, we can lay all the plans at the RNC, and if the governor comes in and says something different, that's going to change things.
Do you think the president's having these discussions with the RNC, or because he doesn't like bad news, could he be in the dark about the possibility of changes at his convention?
So the New York Times had a story this week that mm-hmm. said, you know, so in that interview with Ronna McDaniel, she said, well, we're moving full speed ahead. Come July 1st, we may start adjusting the convention if we have to. The Times reported that they're kind of already having those conversations, and that the president, you know, he just kind of threw out there, like, why don't we go move this to Florida? I think that the phase two news, the announcement this week, was really bad news for holding a convention, because we did an interview with Mandy Cohen, and she said that she considers delegates as spectators. And that's important, because that means that, like Eric said, you could only have 10 people as of now in the arena, 10 delegates. You could have more people at Ray's Splash Planet, the little water park uptown, than you could at the RNC.
They should move the convention there.
But right now they're just in a – I don't see how this moves forward. Unless something changes in a couple of weeks.
So if the RNC proceeds, and they may not, they will likely not be the only convention in town that week. They won't even be the only gathering of Republicans in town that week. A group of shadow Republicans is planning a gathering too. The National Republican Party was founded by former North Carolina Supreme Court Justice Bob Orr.
Let's bring everybody together so that the public, the voting public, and particularly swing voters, critical voters who don't like Trump but aren't necessarily comfortable voting Democratic, they can see that there are all of these Republicans, both from the national level to the state and local level, with impeccable Republican credentials, who are saying this man should not be reelected. He is a danger to the country, and I would submit a danger to the Republican Party.
Evan McMullen is a former CIA officer. He's the other co-founder, and they're calling their gathering the Convention on Founding Principles. If they come here, and if there's a Republican National Convention, won't they get lost in the shuffle? Will anybody know they're here?
Well, I think Ray's Splash Planet is still available.
Well, I don't think they picked a venue yet, so maybe that's wise. Okay, before we run out of time, Annie, while some universities across the country are planning to be exclusively online this fall, others are shifting their calendars. That's what the UNC system is doing. What's their plan?
So their plan is to start early, end early, and minimize kids leaving and coming back to campus. So fall break is going to be canceled. They're going to observe the federal holidays, I believe, and they're going to try to get everyone out by Thanksgiving break. So you won't have kids leaving to go all over the country and then coming back for finals. And so that's the plan that they're going with.
And then State Superintendent of Education Mark Johnson announced this week that the task of monitoring the reading skills of students in grades K through 3 will fall to local school districts next year. This has to do with a decision to abandon a statewide system that he was very much in favor of called iStation. Fill us in.
Yeah, so this saga has been going on for almost a year now. Mark Johnson has been pushing this program called iStation, and there's been a court case and a lot of disputes, and I guess the final resolution is local districts can use whatever they want to measure read to achieve for the next year.
Two pieces of news about growth in Charlotte. As I mentioned at the very beginning of the program, we are now the 15th most populous city in the country. We just pushed San Francisco out of that spot. We surpassed Indianapolis a year ago. And actually, these figures are from 2018-19, so we may even be higher than that today. These come from the census. Zillow reports that there is an markedly increased number of home searches for homes in Charlotte by people living in New York. COVID-19 related, do you think?
Oh, my gosh.
Yes, indeed. That's it. We're out of time. Eric Spanberg joined us from the Charlotte Business Journal. Annie Ma, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Jonathan Lowe, anchor reporter for Spectrum News. And Steve Harrison, reporter for WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Wendy Herkey is the executive producer. The senior producer is Aaron Kiever. Chris Miller is the producer. Our assistant producer is Jesse Steinmetz. Our production assistant is Jennifer Warsham. And our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, go to wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.